Support for LAist comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years of Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, with over 200 films May 1st through 10th. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, a live literary event series from LAist. We are back with guests, author Amanda Montell and actor Bella Lavelle. You can find us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum. Tickets at laist.com/events.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope your weekend was good. It's going to be a challenging week, potentially, for parents in the LA Unified School District. Hanging over families' heads is the potential of a walkout by district personnel starting tomorrow. This would be a three-day strike organized by Local 99 of the Service Employees International Union. They're seeking a number of things, including additional compensation and hours for their employees. And United Teachers Los Angeles, the union that represents teachers, has said that they will observe that strike by Local 99. They will not cross picket lines. And LA Unified Superintendent Alberto Carvalho says the schools will not be able to open if the teachers and the SEIU employees all walk off the job effective tomorrow. Now, over the weekend, the school district tried to get the State Public Employment Relations Board to put an injunction in place that would have delayed or stopped the strike from happening. Now, California PERB said that it would not immediately do that. However, they are taking up the matter in more detail today. It's still possible that PERB could decide that they're going to block the strike tomorrow. On the other hand, they have not taken that step at this point and may not take that step. And so parents may find themselves with a closed school starting tomorrow. My question for you is, if you have a child that's in an LA Unified school, what are your plans? What are you planning to do tomorrow through Thursday if the strike goes through and if your school does not open tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday? We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. I'd really like to hear from you. What are your plans for dealing with the potential of your school's closure if your child attends an LA Unified district-run school? 866-893-5722, or you can email us what your plan is to atcomments@laist.com. Please include your location and your first name. And if you could add the name of your child's school, that would be even better yet. If you'd prefer not mentioning that, that's also fine. Joining me to talk about the tremendous challenge this poses for teachers and students is Los Angeles Times Metro reporter Sonia Sharp. Sonia, thank you very much for being with us. You've been talking with parents to get their input. What have they been saying?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. And yes, I've been talking to parents. And the thing that most parents were saying, at least late last week, was, what? There was a lot of shock.
They weren't concern, alone.
Disbelief. Yes, I know. I think a lot of people were caught unawares about this strike. And there's, you know, lots of reasons for that. But if you compare it to, I remember back in 2019, we saw tremendous parent support for the teacher strike, the 6-day teacher strike at that time. And it feels like a very different landscape right now.
Yeah, and that was anticipated that there could be the major job action that time around. This one seemed to catch, I think, most of us off guard. And for parents, this is particularly going to be a challenge. Now, one of the things, I thought this was rather impressive, the mayor's office announcing that they're going to be setting up at recreational centers throughout the city of Los Angeles, places places where kids can be dropped off and also where grab-and-go food is going to be provided should the schools shut down. If the schools don't, then these would not be operative. But if they do, there are going to be the different recreational centers. They'll have after-school program at 30 of the centers. It'll be free, available to elementary school students from 7:30 in the morning till 6 in the evening. The zoo is going to be available with special programs, and LA public libraries are also going to have special programs that their staff members are putting on. This all put together within a matter of days, Sonia.
Yes, and I think, you know, a lot of what we're seeing now in terms of the Parks Department, the mayor's office, in terms of the libraries, these are things that kind of to me, look very similar to stuff we started to see in the pandemic, right? During the campus closures, there were lots and lots of families who couldn't keep their children home. We think about, for example, healthcare workers, right? Healthcare is tremendously female dominated. Lots and lots of primary caregivers could not keep their children home. And these structures sprang up to support them, not necessarily in the numbers or at the speed that many parents needed at the time. But what I'm seeing emerge now does to me look like stuff that was almost built at that time and kind of reemerging now in this moment of emergency. But you're totally right. It feels unprecedented, the level of response. And part of that is because, again, we haven't seen a situation where campuses were totally closed. Even the last strike, people were still able to bring their kids to campus. Food was still available. That's a big issue, right? Is so many children in this district rely on meals from the school. And those very workers are the ones who are leading this strike. And so exactly how kids are going to get fed is of top concern to lots of families.
Yeah, well, I have to say, I was very impressed. Now, I don't know when it comes actually on the ground, the delivery of the child care and the meals and all. Hopefully that, if there is the strike and the schools close, that all works out. I mean, we spend plenty of time on this program talking about things provided by our state government that don't work right. So if the city of LA is actually able to do this, kudos to them for what's a very ambitious backfilling for parents to provide them with community support. Again, I'd like to hear from you as an AirTalk listener. If you have a child in the LA Unified School District, what contingency plans are you in the process of making or have already consolidated around for the coming 3 days if schools close starting tomorrow? We're at 866-893-5722. Very important we hear from you. If you have a child in the LA Unified School District, you can also email your input to atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and your first name so that we have a sense of where you are. Please let us know, what are your plans for dealing with this? If you're an employee of the district, this is not a place necessarily to lobby on behalf of the union or to express dismay if you're not happy with what your union's doing, but I'm just interested in hearing about the practical plans that are being made for the campus where you work. 866-893-5722 or email us at atcomments@las.com. We're talking with Sonia Sharp. She's Metro reporter for the Los Angeles Times. For so many working parents, Sonia, this is going to be tremendously challenging for them because, in some cases, I assume they're not going to be able to go to work if they have particularly young kids.
Well, I certainly have colleagues who are not going to go to work, but because they have young kids and they will be taking care of them. But the difference between obviously my colleagues who are also union represented and, you know, we get paid time off, and many, if not most of the parents who are impacted in this way do not, right? So they have to negotiate with bosses. They have to explain. I was talking to one mother who cleans houses. She, you know, it's not only just that she won't be paid for the time, but that she might lose the relationship with that client. And then there's a matter of, you know, if you lose that money, how are you going to pay rent? How are you going to put food on the table? People are already strapped, stressed out that they're not going to have the meals that they were expecting for their kids necessarily, right? Access to that. I know they're working very, very hard on the district level to make that happen, but it's not quite clear how it will yet or if it will reach the people that it needs to. And folks are stressed out about that money.
Yeah. And unlike the pandemic where kids were home for an extended period, there won't be online instruction here because there won't be teachers to provide that online instruction. So it's not as though the parents can just be working if they do have that capability of working at home. As you said, the majority of parents in the district probably don't. But even in those cases, if they could, you know, you can't have your kid doing distance learning at a time like this because there won't be any provided.
That's right. So I know the district sent home in many cases 10 days worth of schoolwork to give parents flexibility to make sure that everybody was prepared for any eventuality. But the difficulty, I have a first grader, you know, my first grader is very smart, very capable, very dedicated, but he cannot do his homework on his own. He doesn't read at a level to be able to both understand the instructions and complete them. And also he's wiggly, you know, teachers are experts, right? Teachers are experts at getting our kids to sit down and focus and do the work and redirecting them. And we do it for homework for maybe an hour at a time in the evenings. But if you have a child who's first, second, third grade learning those critical skills, right, that they absolutely need to master, particularly with reading and writing, so that they do not fall behind in further grades, you have to be on them.
All right. Thank you so much, Sonia. Great to have your observations as a parent as well. As a journalist, she's Metro reporter for the LA Times. She's been talking with parents, getting their reactions to dealing with a potential strike starting tomorrow that would close all LA Unified Schools. Sonia Sharp of the Los Angeles Times. Caitlin and Mar Vista said, I'm trying to help out my friends whose kids are in the district, providing extra play dates and childcare. I also have kids in the district, and I'm planning to walk the picket line alongside union members. That's Caitlin in Mar Vista.
Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Ghost Waltz by Oliver Mayer, a bold original recovery of Juventino Rosas, one of Mexico's most significant composers. Follow Rosas from his father's early death to his friendship with ragtime genius Scott Joplin, now on stage through June 2nd. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Support for LAist comes from Pasadena Water and Power, inviting everyone to join the ripple effect. Water plays a pivotal role in our lives, and every individual's actions matter in preserving this resource. Each action we take starts the ripple of change, making a greater impact throughout the community. Be part of the ripple effect and learn more about water programs, workshops, and ways to save at pwpweb.com/the ripple effect.
As rain continues to fall over the next couple days in much of Southern California, it's a continuing story this rainy season of record high rainfall and of snowpack in the Sierra and elsewhere in the state. The wonderful news, we're seeing surface reservoirs at or above where they need to be at this time of year. We are out of drought conditions in the vast majority of California. The news is good on so many different levels. But one of the ongoing effects of years of drought and the overall aridification or drying out of the American West is what's happened with our groundwater. Because of heavy levels of pumping, particularly during drought years, the aquifers beneath the Central Valley of California are severely depleted. Aquifers elsewhere have had very heavy demand put on them, and that has been a challenge for banking our stormwater runoff in ways beyond surface reservoirs. They're, of course, important, but the capacity of what can be stored underground is absolutely awesome. For example, in the Central Valley, more money can be stored underground there than in the entirety of Lake Mead, which is the largest above-ground reservoir in the United States. So what's being done to recharge that groundwater? Joining us, the chair of the California Water Resources Control Board, E. Joaquin Esquivel. Thank you so much, Joaquin, for joining us to talk about this. So share with us what new is being done by the state to try and bank more of this water.
It's really great to be here with you this morning. And just thanks for everything you and your team do, Larry.
Thank you.
I'm really proud of actually a suite of things that the State Water Board has been doing for a number of years to actually try to streamline the permitting side with water rights associated with groundwater recharge. I think, as everyone knows, our water rights system can sometimes not be the most sophisticated system that we have, insofar as it's a light touch. We've always had here in the state, compared to other Western states, something of a light touch around water rights. And what it means is these moments when you have competing interests looking to recharge that water in various watersheds, there can be disagreement. There can be challenges around who we can say, yes, you know, can receive that water, but then also how to recharge that water in ways that is protective of communities' water quality. We know we have real generational challenges with water quality in the Central Valley and other places where nitrates are contaminating groundwater. So taking those factors in consideration, the water rights needs, means that the board for a few years now has been trying to set up different tools. Here, temporary permits that let us here more quickly say yes to these, what are, as we see, temporary phenomena. The reality is that wet years like this haven't been coming very often. And so the investments needed both on the permitting side, but also on the physical infrastructure to move that water around in moments like this can sometimes be a hurdle. So the board, as I said, has done some good streamlining. It's meant that this year alone, we're able to quickly process what were 8 permits, 7 of those for 180-day temporary type permits. 1 is a new type of permit, which is lasts for 5 years, which helps kind of span the scope of what can be a number of years where you may not necessarily need that permit, because a lot of these discussions really they need to happen in the summer. They need to happen before the water is hitting the watershed so that we can permit them. We can say yes. And so the board has done a lot of work on that side.
No, I just wanted to follow up and talk about some of the controversy over this, because you have some environmental critics who say diverting water, say, from the San Joaquin River to replenish groundwater, that that groundwater is going to serve Central Valley farmers, ag interests, but isn't really going to go to the property owners, the people that live in the Central Valley who've seen their wells run dry, who are dealing with contamination of the groundwater on their property. They're not really going to be the ones able to draw on that. Can you respond to that critique?
Yeah, I think the nature of our groundwater basins is that everyone that's dependent on that groundwater basin benefits from recharge activities. I think that a lot of the work that we're looking to do this year particularly is in the non-permitted space, where when we're fighting floods, as we are now in so many parts of our communities, the incidental recharge that comes from fighting those floods goes and benefits to the groundwater resources that we're managing. So being able to permit and streamline projects in ways that, again, are actually protective by ensuring that we're not recharging on dairy lands, we're not recharging on lands that had fertilizers or pesticides applied to them, is protective of communities. And again, because all groundwater users are dependent on the basin, making sure that waters are captured and those levels are recharged benefits everyone. But I understand that there can sometimes be a feeling that the decision making or the work is here primarily benefiting ag. But I think the reality is, especially in our communities, that there are complex issues amongst that. And there are real questions around access. And I think we need to keep those front and center as well.
We're talking with the chair of the California Water Resources Control Board, E. Joaquin Esquivel. Also with us is Stefan Tucker, who's general manager of the Water Replenishment District Groundwater Agency serving Southern L.A. County. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. Just share with us here in the southern part of the state what's being done to try and increase the amount of stormwater capture.
Thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be able to share some of what's going on with Southern Los Angeles County and how we're capturing water. We've done a great job this year with all of the storms that have been coming through and capturing water from primarily the San Gabriel Mountains area and most of the upper part of Southern Los Angeles County. Normally, in an average year, we would capture about 54,000 acre-feet of water. Before these last two storms, we got a report that we had already captured 72,000 acre-feet of water in our groundwater basins that we manage. And then the Upper San Gabriel groundwater basin, they had captured 83,000 acre-feet of water. That's a huge amount of water that's been captured already and put into the ground for future use. In addition to that, LA County Flood Control tells us that they're holding back another 100,000 acre-feet of water in the mountains for release when it can be percolated into the ground.
And so that what's being held up in the mountains in those reservoirs, that's then sent down through spillways into spreading grounds. And where are those spreading grounds typically located?
They're located in the upper part of the LA Basin, right at the base of the San Gabriel Mountains. We have the Rio Hondo spreading grounds. That's in the Montebello area, and the San Gabriel River spreading grounds, that's in the Pico Rivera area, and then the main basin, which is San Gabriel Basin, up by Duarte area, they have another spreading grounds that they release water into.
And is the Hanson Dam area able to be used for that in the city of L.A. or not?
The Hanson Dam area primarily releases water into the Pacoima and Tahunga spreading ground areas in the northern San Fernando Valley.
All right. So this obviously is part of an effort to capture an ever higher percentage of stormwater runoff. What infrastructure projects are in the works to expand on this, Stefan?
We've always got infrastructure projects that can take as much of that water as possible. Specifically, we are really just kind of dredging and trying to maintain our spreading grounds as we see them now so they can take and infiltrate more and more water. The biggest problem is that the water comes down faster than we can percolate the water. So maintaining those spreading grounds is of utmost importance so that water can percolate as quickly as possible and we can capture it as quickly as we can as it comes down. We would love to have, you know, more open space where we can have more retention basins for that water. But unfortunately, L.A. is pretty built.
It's very built. It's hard to do it. Not like the old days where the L.A. Basin used to flood regularly and all that water would seep into the aquifer. Stefan Tucker, thank you very much. General Manager of the Water Replenishment District. The Groundwater Agency serves Southern L.A. County. And our thanks to E. Joaquin Esquivel, who chairs the California Water Resources Control Board. We'll have obviously more of this as our rainy season continues. We'll keep you updated on this right here on LAist 89.3.
Support for LAist comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Ghost Waltz by Oliver Mayer, a bold original recovery of Juventino Rosas, one of Mexico's most significant composers. Follow Rosas from his father's early death to his friendship with ragtime genius Scott Joplin, now on stage through June 2nd. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Support for LAist comes from Pasadena Water and Power, inviting everyone to join the ripple effect. Water plays a pivotal role in our lives, and every individual's actions matter in preserving this resource. Each action we take starts the ripple of change, making a greater impact throughout the community. Be part of the ripple effect and learn more about water programs, workshops, and ways to save at pwpweb.com/the ripple effect.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Thank you so much for your support. It means the world to us. Well, yet another thing to attribute to our warming climate is an earlier start of allergy season. That's something that has physicians concerned about how to help their patients deal with the effects of that. Plus, with heavy rainfall, and I was not aware of this, it creates its own allergy problems. I always thought the rain was beneficial in avoiding allergies. We only had to be aware of the stuff that grew as a result of the rainfall, but that is not true. And joining us to give us a fuller picture of allergies and when the season starts is Professor of Allergy and Immunology at UCLA School of Medicine, Dr. Maria Garcia-Uret. Dr. Garcia-Uret, thank you very much for being with us. Let's start with all this rain that we've been getting. How does rain affect our allergies?
Well, Larry, in different ways, depending how much. A small amount of rain, you know, maybe a little shower here and there, cleans the air, you know, mostly from air pollutants with, you know, not that much of pollen themselves is good for nature. What has happened in this particular season with the record, you know, rainfalls and thunderstorms is ironically has made allergies worse. We have known for a very long time that if with a thunderstorm, when water hits the ground where pollen normally lies, it breaks it into smaller particles, and these smaller particles of pollen are easier to transport both across and upwards, and therefore, what is a little bit of rain is beneficial. A lot, a thunderstorm creates these microparticles of pollen that travel further and higher and cause a worsening in allergy symptoms. We have known this for a very long time, what is called the thunderstorm asthma, that almost exclusively affects patients that have allergies that perhaps before they didn't even know that they had, you know, asthma or a component of asthma. So what you mentioned, you know, we have two complications here with climate change. We have a more prolonged pollen season, now 3-4, probably even 5 days earlier, and now in Southern California, the worst season is end of January, end of May, and with this very intense rains, there is more pollen and more pollen suspended in the air.
We're talking with Dr. Maria Garcia-Uret, who is professor of allergy and immunology, a pediatrician as well, UCLA School of Medicine, and we invite your questions for her about seasonal allergies, how the warming climate and the heavy rain that we've gotten here in Southern California are affecting and are likely to affect people's allergies going forward. We're at 866-893-5722, or you can email your question at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Dr. Garcia-Uret, are we anticipating once the rains are done and we get all the plant growth that have been spurred by this rain that we're going to have a particularly tough pollen season in the spring?
Well, we are in the spring already, Larry.
Later spring, right? Yeah.
I think the benefits of water on plant growth and propagation cannot be overstated. There will be more blooming, and probably the season is going to be more intense. Patients with allergies need to keep a close eye on worsening symptoms of cough, eye, itching, pruritus, and as I told you, in some of them, it could get to the point of feeling, you know, lower airway or almost like wheezing symptoms. I usually or characteristically, you know, the pollen season, the worst of the pollen season, is up until the month, you know, mid June or end of June. So we have to perhaps keep it together, be on on the lookout of symptoms. I haven't there, you know, been there before until the end of June. I'm hoping that that's where the worst of it would have passed. What happens also in this time of the year is that we have what we call the perfect storm. This year we had an enormous, like a surge in respiratory infections. And it's not only COVID, you know, it's RSV, it's a variety of flu, a variety of respiratory viruses that usually start around maybe after Halloween. You know, people start getting sick and sick and sick because of respiratory infections, and then comes January that pulls over, and with this rains, the allergy season, and people essentially feel sick, you know, every other week. And we have now to compound the fact that COVID has been with us now for a very long time. I haven't, you know, I have heard of so many people, you know, with allergies that are being tested themselves every day, every other day, just in case they have COVID. And it's either another virus or allergies or a mixture of both.
We're talking with Dr. Maria Garcia Uret of UCLA School of Medicine. She's specialist in allergy and immunology. Dr. Garcia Uret, also we have all this rain which creates dampness. Buildings are damper. We have more standing water. Does this at all play into the way that people have reactions to their allergies?
Well, dampness, you know, always people associate dampness with mold. And so, well, I have a mold allergy. And it is true that in an indoor setting, certain molds with the excessive dampness can cause respiratory symptoms. But there's also outdoor molds that also can travel faster and better, you know, after rain falls and when the storm clears. So I would say that during the wet season, both molds and pollens are probably the triggers of patient symptoms.
All right, so we've got heavy rain has a big effect here. The warming climate has an effect with an earlier allergy season. Dr. Garcia Uret, thank you so much for walking us through this and helping to prepare us for what's coming our way in 2023. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
The professor of allergy and immunology, a pediatrics department at the UCLA School of Medicine, Dr. Maria Garcia Uret. You're listening to Air Talk on LAist 89.3. More than 150 years ago, the U.S. government and the Navajo Nation signed treaties promising the tribe a permanent home, which is now a massive reservation in the Four Corners area of the American Southwest. And included in that promise is that there would be a sufficient water supply for the Navajo Nation. But subsequently, there have been a number of deals that have been made about the Colorado River and its water flows that have left the Navajo Nation with a significant percentage of its homes without any running water. Water that has to be trucked in, a shortage of water for Navajo agricultural and personal usage as well. So the U.S. Supreme Court hearing arguments today on a case that can determine to what extent the Navajo Nation can draw on the Colorado River for its water. With us is Bloomberg Law Supreme Court reporter Kimberly Robinson. Kimberly, very good to have you with us today. How have the arguments progressed so far?
Well, the arguments are over here in Washington, D.C., and it looks like it's going to be a very close case. We saw really the justices split half and half with Justice Amy Coney Barrett in the middle. And, you know, that's really where we stand until we get the opinion from the justices before June.
All right. And the district court in this case sided with the Navajo Nation, didn't it?
Well, the district court actually sided with the federal government.
Oh, it did.
The Ninth Circuit brought the case back to life. And the question now for the justices is whether or not the Navajo Nation can continue to seek the federal government's help in obtaining that water that it so dearly needs in the water crisis that you all know is happening throughout the Southwest.
And what are the legal issues that are at play here that you heard the justices bringing up during the course of the arguments?
Well, you mentioned some treaties dating back to the 1800s, and the question is really, what do those treaties require the federal government to do? So the Navajo Nation says that the federal government has to ensure that it has sufficient water. That means it has to assess the needs that the tribe has and has to come up with a plan for implementing it. The federal government, though, for its part, says, yes, you're entitled to water, and so we will not interfere with your water rights. But if you want something more, you have to go to Congress, not the courts, and ask for it.
All right. We're talking with Kimberly Robinson of Bloomberg Law, also with us from ProPublica, Southwest Environment reporter Mark Olalde. Mark, thank you very much for being with us. What are the stakes in this high court decision?
If I were in Indian country right now, I would be terrified with this case, because the stakes should only be that question that Kimberly was talking about federal trust responsibility. Yet we had a reporter, I just got off the phone with ProPublica reporter Umar Farooq, who's in the court today too, and heard that the questions kept going back to what are called Winner's Doctrine rights. And the Winner's Doctrine is essentially what lays out how tribes across the country get access to water rights and water claims. A quarter of the Colorado River's flow is guaranteed at this point, legally speaking, to tribal reservations around the Colorado River Basin. And it sounds like the conservative justices on the court might take that entire legal precedent, you know, up as part of the decision. So this goes well beyond just the Navajo Nation and could really have implications for water and water deliveries to reservations around the country.
Well, and so would there be then, with the Winters Doctrine of 1908 potentially being overturned, that the tribes would lose the rights that they currently have?
So the Winters Doctrine says that these tribes have rights that are as senior as the creation of their reservation, you know, via federal treaty with the United States government. So very strong, very senior water rights that are very legally protected. If that, you know, kind of bedrock precedent from 115 years ago disappears, I couldn't tell you what would happen. A lot of these rights have already been settled via state courts, via agreements with states and a myriad other parties. So it would definitely kind of shake water law on you know, an Indian country to its core. And there are still a number of tribes, still about a dozen tribes in the Colorado River Basin itself that haven't finished kind of quantifying, settling, let alone developing their water rights via the Winters Doctrine. So if the court were to go as far as taking on and making a decision on the Winters Doctrine, which they really don't need to in this case, but if they did that, yeah, it would definitely throw the future of water law in Indian country kind of into question.
And Kimberly Robinson of Bloomberg Law, what are the constitutional issues that are at play here for the justices in determining, you know, which compacts, which doctrines supersede others here for water rights?
Well, really what the justices are looking at are the treaties that you mentioned at the top of this interview. But, you know, there is a principle in constitutional law that when the justices are looking at these agreements, that they're supposed to weigh in favor of the Native American tribes. And so how far that goes when looking at these particular treaties is a question that the justices explored today. And again, you know, I think it's really going to all come down to Justice Barrett, who really seemed to be trying to coalesce around a limited win for Navajo Nation that doesn't speak to all those really big questions about the Winters Doctrine.
Mark, I wanted to ask you about the Navajo Nation specifically. It's a massive reservation. It has relied principally on the Little Colorado River, not on the big river. If they end up prevailing here, what would that mean for the states that have their own deal over the distribution and the split of the Colorado? What would that potentially mean for their share if the Navajo share can come from the big river?
Well, absolutely, it could have an impact. You know, this case should not set a number on how much water the Navajo Nation could get. I mean, it's a question about whether or not the federal government is acting properly in handling their trust responsibility. But I think that worry is very at front of minds for people, because the Colorado River is relied on by 7 states, 30 tribes, 2 countries, 40 million people, billions of dollars of agriculture, and not a drop of the river ends up all the way down in the Sea of Cortez and ultimately the Pacific Ocean. It's all used by the time it gets there. And so we're living in a zero-sum game kind of world where any new drop of water, let alone any new drop of very senior protected water, is allocated. And, you know, so we need to balance that fact with the fact that there is this moral and humanitarian and legal obligation to deliver this water to tribes. But just to put it in perspective, you know, the treaties we're talking about for the Navajo Nation go back to the 1840s, 1860s. The state of Arizona wasn't even created until 1912. And so the water I drink in Phoenix is very low priority, legally speaking. And so, yes, if a lot more senior water right claims are made on the Colorado River or the Colorado River system, what does that mean for populations in Phoenix and Los Angeles and elsewhere who have kind of lower legal standing in their claims to that water? And that's something that is hotly debated right now in water managers up and down the basin. And I think, you know, we're juggling the facts of this water is owed to tribes in a certain capacity and in another capacity. How do we make sure that everyone else, you know, still has all the water that they use and they need?
Kimberly Robinson of Bloomberg Law, if the Navajo Nation prevails in this case before the high court, then I understand it would go back to the U.S. District Court in Arizona. So what would be the next step if that's where the high court came down?
Well, really what the justices are considering today is a very narrow question, just whether or not this case can go forward. So if they decide that it can, it's going to go back to that trial court, and they are going to sort out what the actual trust relationship is between the nation and the federal government and what the federal government has to do, if anything. And so we're really at the beginning stages of this. Even in arguments today, we heard some discussion about what the end game might be. But, you know, the attorney for the tribe stressed that this is still very early on in the process. And, you know, the question before the justices is a really narrow one at this point.
All right. I want to thank you both for being with us. Kimberly Robinson, Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg Law. Mark Olalde joining us from ProPublica, where Mark covers Southwest environmental issues for ProPublica. Thank you both so much. We'll pay close attention to this U.S. Supreme Court with a decision to be announced later this year.
Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Ghost Waltz by Oliver Mayer, a bold original recovery of Juventino Rosas, one of Mexico's most significant composers. Follow Rosas from his father's early death to his friendship with ragtime genius Scott Joplin, now on stage through June 2nd. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Support for LAist comes from Pasadena Water and Power, inviting everyone to join the ripple effect. Water plays a pivotal role in our lives, and every individual's actions matter in preserving this resource. Each action we take starts the ripple of change, making a greater impact throughout the community. Be part of the ripple effect and learn more about water programs, workshops, and ways to save at pwpweb.com/the ripple effect.
With us on Air Talk, I'm Larry Mantle. Again, thank you for your support. You mean the world to us. We wouldn't be here without you, and we thank you for that every single day. It's been 20 years since the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq began. We have some key dates from that invasion. First President George W. Bush called the U.S.-led invasion March 20th, 2003, a mission to free the Iraqi people and to root out weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein's government was toppled just 26 days later. But 2 years later, the CIA's chief weapons inspector reported there were no stockpiles of nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons ever found. The war deposed a dictator whose imprisonment, torture, and execution of dissenters kept 20 million people living in fear for a quarter of a century. But it also broke what had been a unified state in the heart of the Arab world and created a power vacuum. So the question is, what is Iraq like today, 20 years later? And what are some of the thoughts and memories of Iraqi Americans living right here in Southern California? It's my pleasure to welcome research fellow at the Arab American Civic Council, an advocacy nonprofit based in Anaheim, Amin Nash. Amin, thank you for coming in studio and talking with us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, and I really appreciate you giving us a voice.
Well, let's start, first of all, what is your sense of where Iraq as a nation is today?
Today, you know, it's definitely the feel of the people. I was just there in New Year's, and it's kind of improving. The feel of the people is improving. However, they still live in a sense of hopelessness. The infrastructure is terrible. There's no clean water, or there's no sewage cleanup. The trash everywhere. Electricity goes off every 6 hours. They have to pay for two services of electricity every time it goes in and out.
A lot of people have generators, I understand.
Yeah, so you're paying the government and you're paying a private company for a generator. So it's kind of like you're paying two things. So it's still difficult. It's really hard just to live. However, when I was just there, the sense of hope is kind of, I would say it's like 10% right now. You know, it went from 0% to 10%. It's improving.
So better than it was, but still a lot of hopelessness.
Yeah.
You grew up here, but your parents are from Baghdad,
I understand. Yeah.
How close a connection do you feel with the people of Iraq?
Very, very, very close. Yeah, they every day, I remember growing up, I would talk to my my family on the phone. I remember specifically in the 90s, my parents would call my uncle, who was held as a prisoner of war during the Iran-Iraq war. And we were trying to get a toilet for him because when he was a prisoner of war, they beat the nerves out of him. So I remember that. I remember growing up just trying to get a toilet for him and talking to them. And I'm always connected to them. You know, 90% of my family's over there. We're kind of like the displaced ones, you could say.
So when you go there, you're visiting family.
100%. Yeah, I'm always with my family and spending time with them. It's the best times of my life over there.
So you just turned a teenager when the invasion occurred.
Yeah.
What are your memories of that time?
You know, I hated it, to be honest. I was confused. I was frustrated. I did feel powerless. You know, I was a teenager growing up, coming into my time, and I just kind of I was going to school in Las Vegas, Nevada. And at the time, Nevada was the lowest ranked school, so I was just trying to get good grades. And on top of that, you have to throw in, I have a family who are getting kidnapped, family who is dying, family who are disappearing. So it was just, I was being accused of being a terrorist. You know, my identity was going through a lot of struggles. And, you know, I at the end of the day, though, you know, I wanted the same thing that many Americans and many Iraqis want to do. And we just wanted to see peace and terrorism to go away, the dictatorship to go away. And so it was tough, you know.
Yeah, you mentioned about, you know, the challenges being an Iraqi American, and, you know, following, I think you were 11 when the attack on the World Trade Center occurred, 13 with the invasion of Iraq. So, what did you have to deal with as a result of the discrimination and blame that came the way of people like yourself?
You know, the best way I could describe it is like I was always on the parole, and the world was a parole officer. You know what I mean? It's just, I felt like I was almost under the scrutiny almost everywhere I went with friends. They always asked me questions about, do I belong here? And school administration would ask me questions about my heritage, my culture. And then, you know, when I go to the airport, I was 12 years old, 13 years old, getting pulled to the side and going through like a checkpoint. They have these air things that blow air in your pockets. And I didn't know that existed, but I was in a white room doing that. So, you know, it's that's just the administration level. When it comes to discrimination, it was always being constantly questioned about my heritage, about my culture. However, I would mention that I kind of grew up lucky because I had a lot of friends that were empathetic with me. And after they understood, especially like I had a lot of immigrant friends from Mexico, you know, a lot of Filipino friends, and they just, they were connected with me because
so they share that immigrant experience.
Correct. Yeah.
Different sources, places of origin, but similar kinds of experience.
Yeah, exactly. And it brought a sense of comfort.
We're talking with Amin Nash, who's research fellow with the Arab American Civic Council, Iraqi American, grew up here, but his parents from Baghdad. They came in the late 70s, and talking about the 20 years now since the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Also joining us is Jose Serrano, a church and community engagement director for the Greater L.A. and Orange County's World Relief Southern California. It's a global Christian humanitarian organization based in Garden Grove. Jose, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it. Speak, if you will, to the displacement of Iraqis, and you know, many of whom came here to California. What was that experience like?
Good morning. Thank you for having me. So the experience of many people, first of all, we are a refugee resettlement agency, the World Relief Southern California office, and we saw large numbers of people from Iraq arriving in the early 2000s into the mid-2000s, like 2013, 2015, and there is so much pain. There are a few things to talk about. Not only did the war create mass destruction and destroy the communities in Iraq, but also it caused great displacement. And with that displacement, the families that have arrived continue to suffer from a large number of emotional and psychological challenges and issues, as well as the internal conflict of being in a safe space, which is the United States, but also mourning still the losses of family and their homes back in Iraq. In addition to that, there's family separation that continues to happen. Not all people have reunited, especially with previous administrations cutting the ceiling to a very minimal number of people arriving as refugee. And so that pipeline has decreased as time has gone by. And so families continue to be separated after being displaced from the war in 2003.
What sorts of aid is your organization and others providing for those families?
So one of the things that we focus here at World Relief Southern California is we provide not only immigration legal services we try to help and assist with family reunification. So petitioning family members so that they can reunite with their loved ones. So not separating families, but reuniting them. And then the second thing is holistic care. Oftentimes, not only as families arrive, do we help and guide and provide services that will help them reach stability in the United States as refugees, but also just creating community. We live, or our office is very close to Little Arabia, which is a destination for many Iraqi people, as well as El Cajon in San Diego. And so we actually have a new office right now in the San Diego region who is also providing services to communities just like people from Iraq so that they can feel like they belong here in the United States.
We're talking with Jose Serrano, who's Church and Community Engagement Director at World Relief Southern California. He directs those areas for the Greater LA and Orange County area. Also with us, Amin Nash, Research Fellow at the Arab American Civic Council. Amin, I want to ask you about the challenge, at least I would think it would be, for Iraqis living under Saddam Hussein, which is a terrible experience, but there's a degree of stability under that.
Yeah.
So the U.S. invades and comes in, and there's hope, okay, maybe we get rid of Saddam, and then there's open democracy, and we advance economically. It doesn't quite happen, you know, fits and starts, so to speak. What is that like to go through that? And do you have significant numbers of people who sort of pine for the authoritarian regime because at least it was stable?
Yeah, there was a study that was done, I think, in Europe, but they asked a large number of Arabs across the Middle East, what kind of government do you prefer, democratic or authoritarian? And they just, one of the answers they gave was just something that works, right? So a lot of Iraqis, you know, when I just went back there, I had to talk with my cousins, and I was like, how do you guys feel about Saddam being gone? They will say, when he was there, it was stable, it was in control, but he was a dictator. right? He would spy on people. He would send people to get kidnapped sometimes.
Yeah, it was stable if your family wasn't victimized by
correct.
The regime.
Yeah, yeah. And in my case, my family, we come up from a certain neighborhood, and we were there was members of my family who were spied. There's extended family members, you know, friends of my dad's who went missing and kidnapped. You know, and there's stories of people in El Cajon, you know, they family members who would have to pay for every bullet that was shot by Saddam Hussein when he kidnapped their family. So, you know, you have that fear when you're living in Saddam. And now, you know, it's just kind of, you know, there's a sense of freedom, but it's just nothing's in control. And everybody it's just a chaotic freedom. You know what I mean? People are just coming up with their own stories and stuff or their own things to do. So I would say, you know, like Iraq has always been under trouble for almost 40, 50 years. And, you know, when you see a vacuum opened up after the U.S. invaded and came in and occupied the area, there was no central plan to, you know, get the country stabilized. So, of course, it's just going to open up when people, you can't really give freedom to people who don't know what freedom is, right?
I want to thank you, Amin, for coming in. Really appreciate your joining us. Talk about the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
Thank you. Amin Nash joining us from the Arab American Civic Council. Also, our thanks to Jose Serrano of World Relief, Southern California. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. So often on Air Talk and, you know, with other media organizations, we talk about species that are endangered and how fragile their continued existence are. But we're going to spend our final segment today on the success stories, on the stories of species that had been endangered that have seen their numbers rebound considerably. And exhibit A for this are the elephant seals. Not necessarily the most attractive of creatures, but impressive they are. They are massive. And when you see them lounging on the beaches of Central California, they are a sight to behold. With us to talk about the rebound of elephant seals as well as other species that have been endangered. From the Sausalito-based Marine Mammal Center, Associate Director Adam Ratner. Adam, thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to talk about elephant seals.
Yeah, so how, first of all, what steps were taken to protect them and how did they end up working?
The elephant seal story is truly amazing. So this is an animal that was essentially declared extinct back in the late 1800s. They were hunted for their blubber, just like whales. And we thought they were truly gone. The researchers, scientists went close to 30 years without seeing them and then found a small population, less than 100 individuals on an island in Mexico. So we had a second chance to really bring this animal back from the brink. They protected that island. They let the population kind of start to grow. And then things like the Marine Mammal Protection Act, Endangered Species Act, and just a huge amount of community support has given these animals the chance to essentially fully recover. They're now over 175,000.
Oh, my gosh.
From 175,000 in just around 100 years.
And are there any concerns, do you know, since it started from a fairly small surviving population, is that a problem genetically that there were so few numbers, or is that not so much an issue in terms of their overall health?
It is a wonderful success story, but they're not out of the woods yet. To your point, they all come from that same group of 100, so they don't have a lot of genetic diversity. So big shifts in the environment could make them particularly vulnerable. That's one of the reasons the Marine Mammal Center is paying close attention to them, looking at issues like climate change and rising sea levels and the impact that that might have on their breeding beaches. And it's why we need to continue to take action on all these global threats. The elephant seals have had a great second chance. We need to make sure that it stays that way.
With them protected from humans, are there any other species that pose a threat to the elephant seals?
You started by sharing how big some of these animals are. And when you're 5,000 pounds, that's more than the entire starting offense of an NFL football team, you don't have to worry about too many things. For the pups, it's a little bit of a different story. So things like orcas and white sharks are their two main predators.
Were they hunted for oil like whales? Is that what made them popular and led them to nearly be extinct?
They were hunted just like with the whales. Elephant seals always come up onto the same beaches, which makes it really great to go out and actually be able to see them as individuals today. But it also made them particularly easy targets. And they are quite blubberous. So that oil was really valuable back in the 1800s. Luckily, we've been able to completely shift our economy to things that allow us to protect some of these animals moving forward.
And again, if you want to see them and you haven't had a chance to do so, there's some tremendous vantage points along the Central California coast. Adam, where do you think the best place is to see them?
Oh, you can't make me choose amongst them, but there are a few really, really good places. A lot of the elephant seals are born on offshore kind of islands like the Channel Islands, but there are three mainland beaches in California. You can go to San Simeon right near Hearst Castle in San Luis Obispo. You might see in the wintertime close to 10,000 elephant seals there. Right near San Mateo in Pescadero, Anino Huevo State Park, or up in Point Reyes National Seashore. Those are going to be the three places to see elephant seals along the California mainland.
And at San Simeon, they built a huge boardwalk so you can walk up and down and not disturb the beach where all these elephant seals are laying there. You can see them and smell them because there's a distinct aroma as well. But it's a must-see if you're driving Highway 1 in Central California or going to Hearst Castle. You absolutely must stop. Adam Ratner with us of the Marine Mammal Center, based in Sausalito. He's Associate Director of Conservation Education. What about other seals? Because weren't there others that became endangered? And it seems like, we've seen other marine mammals really bounce back.
So there are a few other really great success stories. They're not quite as prominent as the elephant seals, though. So you've got animals like the Hawaiian monk seal, the only kind of seal or sea lion found in Hawaii and the most endangered seal or sea lion in the United States. They unfortunately saw their population really declining, but over the last 20 years have been able to make a really great comeback. So their numbers are still small, only around 1,500, but it really does go to show the impact that conservation and rehabilitation efforts can have on this species. Working closely with groups like NOAA, the Marine Mammal Center, and other groups have actually seen over 30% of the monk seals alive today are alive today due to conservation efforts. So we've been able to see how we're taking this model of how we've saved the elephant seal and making sure it gets to the animals that need it the most. So that's one of the things that's really exciting for the Marine Mammal Center's work, as we've actually seen pups that we've brought into rehabilitation, taken care of, released back out to the wild with a second chance at life, and they're actually having pups of their own. So we know we're able to grow the population, which is really fantastic.
Are we concerned at all about overpopulation of elephant seals or of seals themselves because of the protections and predators not really keeping up with the population culling?
Some of these species of seals and sea lions are certainly growing. There are obviously natural limitations in terms of their food supply as well. So we tend to see some of these species go through a little bit of boom and bust cycles. We know with the gray whales, for example, around 20 years ago, we saw the population start to decline because they were struggling to find some food. There's always a tough balance, though, because we know the environment is changing. So we're keeping an eye, always monitoring these populations. But as of right now, there's no sign that these animals are overpopulated in a way that they're damaging the environment.
Adam, thank you so much for joining us to talk about these success stories. We focus often, and rightly so, on species that are endangered, but terrific to see how the protections have paid off in these cases. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
From the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, Associate Director Adam Ratner with us at the center. By the way, they care for wild elephant seals and other marine mammals, providing them with rehabilitation so that ideally they can return to the wild environment.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.